handout this morning. Follow along with what we're talking about. We have a fairly complicated discussion today, and I want you to have all the help you need. So if you don't have a handout, raise your hand and be sure and get one. Passing them out over here and over there. Lon, do you still have some more? I have some more here if you need more. Okay. For those of you who may not have attended all of these lessons, just a brief review. We're looking at a set of manuscripts called Codex Washingtonius. Strange name. Something coming out of Washington that's basically good. It was discovered buried in the sands of Egypt about 100 years ago, a little over 100 years ago, a set of manuscripts of the Gospels, just the four Gospels. Not the rest of the Old Testament, not the New Testament, just those four, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And it languished in the Smithsonian Institute for almost 75 years before men began to look at it and determine that it had a particular attractive interest to it. It appeared to be a very ancient manuscript book. It was actually a book containing the four Gospels, written with the Greek letters, all capital Greek letters, which would indicate that it was very ancient, that it was 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th century. The men who bought the manuscript from the Egyptian antiquities dealer was a man named Freer, who has an art gallery in the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. He bought that manuscript from the antiquities dealer who knew who the treasure hunter was, who had dug them up but didn't want to reveal it because it was illegal, of course, to dig for treasure in the sands of Egypt. There's a lot of stuff buried there over the last 10,000 years. So that manuscript was turned over to Charles Freer for about $7,500, which was a huge amount of money in 1906. He handed it to a man, a professor from the University of Michigan, named Sanders, and Harry Sanders, Henry Sanders, I think that's right, it's Henry. He looked at it very carefully. He compared it with other manuscripts that they knew of at the time. He concluded a priori that the writing suggested to him that it was to be dated to the 3rd or 4th century A.D. And all of the rest of his conclusions were based on that assumption, that it was from that era. He did not consider the possibility that they were 1st century manuscripts, and that has been the material we've been talking about in this class this summer. There are a lot of reasons for believing that these are actually autographs of the Gospels from the writers who wrote them, the authors. Some of them are written in Luke, in particular, was written in Greek and did not need to be translated. Some of the others were written in Aramaic or perhaps Hebrew and had to be translated into Greek. Last week, we looked at the indicators at the ends of each of those four Gospels, something called a colophon, which, when properly interpreted, we think indicates that those four manuscripts were brought consecutively to ON Egypt, close to Cairo, in the years 57, 58, 59, and 60 A.D. But we also know that have shown in the past that those have what are called seals at the ends of each of the Gospels, indicating that it was authenticated and certified by the authors Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And so the circumstantial evidence is building that these were Gospels that actually relate to the eyewitnesses who wrote them, or in Luke's case, the eyewitnesses that he interviewed to put together the Gospel of Luke. Now, today we're going to look at a detail in the Gospel of John in Codex W that indicates that it was one of the primary Gospels that were copied by the other manuscripts that we have. And there are thousands of Bible manuscripts over the early and middle age years of our history. So the Middle Ages saw a great proliferation of copying. And obviously, before there was any printing, that was the only way to get multiple copies. And most of the copies that were made were the term has been used, chained to the lectern. They weren't distributed to the common people. The preachers or priests who held the services weekly had the only copy. And they would pick and choose out of it and teach what they wanted to, I suppose. But that was the situation. Now, in more modern times, scholars have taken all of these manuscripts and ferreted out their relationships. The choice of words and the spelling and so on tells them which are families of manuscripts that were copied from an original source of some sort. Not necessarily the original source, but from an earlier source. But now we're talking about the possibility that we actually have the manuscripts that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John laid their hands upon. And that's a remarkable possibility. So now we're talking about John. We've already talked in detail about Matthew, or the discussion about how he added a genealogy to the first page of the Gospel of Matthew, and the indications there. And then we talked about also Luke and the fact that his is an elegant presentation, a beautiful book written in excellent Greek. And he was a learned man with plenty of education. He interviewed all of his witnesses and put together the Gospel of Luke, and it is a remarkable thing in itself. We looked at the colophons, which are the diagrams at the end that seem to have an indication of the time in which the copy was made. And after last week's presentation, Gordon Watley came to me and he said, "You know, we were talking about the little bird in the middle of those pictures, those diagrams, remember that? And your handout from last time you saw those final pages." He said, "That looks to me like an Egyptian hieroglyph." And I thought, why didn't I think of that? I should have. I have a book of Egyptian hieroglyphics. And one of the things on it is a bird. The bird was engraved in many of the monuments. It's one of the consonants in the words of the Egyptian language. These figures that we call hieroglyphs are not representative, in most cases, of an animal or the sun or a plant or a flower. They represent consonants in words. And the bird is a B, the letter B, in Egyptian writing, not because they use the word bird, but because they have another word that's involved in that. If it were Hebrew or Greek, it wouldn't be a B, but it is an Egyptian. And then it occurred to me that may have something to do with something we'll discuss in coming weeks, who the scribe was, but also the fact that it was done in Egypt. And so So that was kind of interesting. And if you're alert and you know of something like that that is helpful, be sure and tell me about it, because I can't think of everything. I try, but I can't think of everything. Okay. So today, John. John would not be particularly remarkable in the sense of giving us evidence about origins and who copied who, except for the fact that we have a mistake that a scribe made in the Gospel of John. It's not an error that makes a difference in the story, okay? And in fact, we're going to talk in a couple of weeks, we're going to talk about things that are present in Codex, maybe that are not present in some other manuscripts, or things that are present in other manuscripts that are not in Codex Nebula. And so there are omissions and additions, but they are not substantial. They don't change anything about our beliefs, but they do give some interesting clues about the relationships of these manuscripts. If there's a peculiar spelling in one, and then it shows in it some others later on, you know that they were copied from that one that had the peculiarity. And that's what Nestle and Alland, I told you about them before, did 100 years ago. They gathered all these manuscripts together and arranged them in families and decided that they hoped to decide what the originals looked like by tracing these back and trying to see which manuscript came from which previous manuscript, because they were copied sequentially. They're not being printed until the 16th century. So we have now a case of what we think is a first century manuscript and a scribal error. So that's what we're going to look at today, and you have to follow carefully. In the process, we'll get a look at an interesting thing that Jesus taught. And I'll remind you that the pictures of the manuscripts that we see are all online. You can look at them at this particular company in Plano, Texas, that has gathered all of these New Testament manuscripts together. And you can go online, and many of them you can look at on your own computer. And I do that all the time, as you might imagine, in trying to put together these lessons. Okay. Now, the early research was done, as you see here, by Henry Sanders and Lee W. Woodard. Woodard got interested in this manuscript in the 80s, and he has written a couple of books about his interest in it. He was particularly intrigued by the small letters, Aramaic letters in the margins of the manuscript that are written in brown ink and fading. You need to have UV light to see them. We don't look at any of that stuff. I don't speak Aramaic, and so I don't know whether he's right or wrong, and it's difficult to judge. But looking at just the Greek, there are some interesting things that we've been talking about. Okay, so we give them credit. Now, here's the first page of John's manuscript. And like the others, you can read. I don't know if you can read that. We had problems reading the material in the worship service this morning if the lettering is too small. Most of this is going to be bigger than this. But this page is the first page of a choir. Remember, we talked about a choir as folded pages to give a folded edge over here, and most modern books are put together this way, which is much stronger. You can sew through four stacked pages at the fold, and that helps hold the pages in the book. And so there are four double-sized pages folded in half to make eight pages this size, and with the front and the back, there are 16 pages to a standard choir. You can make any number of pages, but they generally put them together in fours, and so that there's 16 pages. And modern books are made that way too. That explains why this left edge is relatively intact, and all of the other edges are eaten away by the by the decay of being buried in the sands for a couple of thousand years. But they were kept dry. That's an amazing thing about the Egyptian stuff buried in Egyptian sands, well wrapped and protected, will last a long, long time. And maybe the people who put it there knew that that was the case. They were giving us a time capsule for when we live. And we're thankful that they did preserve these. So organized this way, the binding is stronger. The first choir of John's Gospel was penned by a different scribe from the other three Gospels and from the letter choirs in John's Gospel, and that's the interesting thing here. This first page was printed on goatskin vellum, and you can tell the difference because of the veins that run through it. These are folds over here, but we're talking about the venations here that are not present in sheepskin vellum, okay? And the junction to the next choir occurs at John 5:11 in the account of the healing of a crippled man at the pool of Bethesda. I always thought that was interesting that there's a hospital near Washington, D.C., where one of my students worked, that's the Bethesda Hospital. I think it's the Naval Hospital, isn't it? And that's that came from this terminology here. So here we have the place at which there was a joining of the first choir of goatskin vellum to the remainder of John's Gospel, which was on sheepskin vellum. And you can see, just looking at it here, that the slope of the writer's inscription here leans to the right, whereas this scribe writes more upright. And note also there seems to be a stain on the page right here. We don't see that anywhere else in any of these Gospels. That seems to be a peculiar thing. And on the opposite side of the page, it doesn't show. It's something on the surface here. We'll talk about that later. All right. So here's the story leading up to the case, and we'll look at those scriptures next. And at the junction of this choir to that choir is the point of interest. First of all, why did they rewrite? It appears that the first 16 pages were rewritten and replaced the original choir that was somehow damaged or removed from John's Gospel for some reason. And at first they looked at this sort of thing and said, well, which was replaced? Was this the original part of the Gospel, and everything from here on toward the end was replaced with sheepskin vellum? Or was this the original part, and something happened to the first choir? And that leads me to believe the stain has something to do with it. And so they went back and recopied the first part of it and put this goatskin against the sheepskin to make the book, which was buried in the sand. Now, we would guess from what I've said there that originally the whole thing was in sheepskin vellum. And something happened to the first bit of it. They took that off and replaced it with a rewrite at a later time. Maybe some decades after it was originally written in the AD 59, I think, or 58 when this one was produced. So maybe around 100 AD, they replaced the first choir, the first 8 pages or 16 pages or 8 leaves of this Gospel. So we got to figure out what's going on there. And something interesting happened at the junction of this one, this sentence, which starts over here and finishes up here. So let's look at that. John 5, you can follow along in your version of the Bible. And that's the neat thing about looking at the Greek New Testament. You have it translated, so So you know what's written in these various pages. To try to find which words match which words in English and Greek is a little more difficult, but that's possible for you to do without even learning Greek. So here we have the story. Now, there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, which in Hebrew is called Bethesda, having five porticoes. I don't know if the name Bethesda comes from the fact that it of five somehow, but anyway, that was a Hebrew name. And in these porticoes, these are porches, in these porches lay a multitude of those who were sick, blind, lame, and withered. And then what is, I don't know if it, in yours, is, if it's darker or not. It was in blue on the screen. You do have it at the bottom down here. It doesn't, when you turn it to black and white, it doesn't make any distinction. But anyway, verses, end of verse 3 and verse 4 are an addition. And it's in brackets, probably in your Bible. It may be in a footnote in your Bible. These sick were laying in those porches around the pool, waiting for the moving of the waters, for an angel of the Lord went down at certain seasons into the pool and stirred up the waters. Whoever then first, after stirring up the water, stepped in, was made well from whatever disease with which he was afflicted. That whole section does not occur in Sinaiticus, Alexandricus, Vaticanus, those three major unseals, and it doesn't occur here in Codex Debian. At some point later on in the history of the Bible, some priest or someone made a note in the margin explaining the context for the story. And it does fit what the man says later on when Jesus talks to him. And so later on it got incorporated into the text itself. It doesn't change anything. It's an addition. But on the other hand, it may be an accurate presentation of what people believed, or it may be something that God did. We don't really know. But anyway, that's the story. Now, a man was there who had been ill for 38 years. That's a long time. Can you remember what you were like 38 years ago? I tried to think 40 years ago, what was I doing? What did I feel like? And so on. But he'd been sick a long, long time, paralyzed. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been a long time in that condition, he said to him, "Do you wish to get well?" And what kind of an answer do you expect? Why, yes. But the man didn't have any notion of the fact that Jesus could help him get well, other than if Jesus would help him get into the water at the appropriate time. And so he says something that's compatible with the explanation that someone added. The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, but while I am coming, another steps down before me." Well, he sort of implied that he would like to get well. He didn't actually answer the question, did he? And we're sometimes asked questions like that, and we give a diverting answer, which tells something about our preconceived ideas. So he couldn't get there because he was crippled. And so it was sort of a standoff, wasn't it? So Jesus said to him, out of the blue, I mean, there's no explanation, there's no presentation or preparation. He just says, "Get up, pick up your pallet, and walk." Wow. And immediately. How soon did that happen? Did he get his strength? Immediately. Immediately the man became well. And so to work a miracle like this, like Jesus did, it doesn't take a lot of prayer and of a period of getting well, he was instantly well. He jumped up. He picked up his pallet and began to walk. But now comes the complication. It was the Sabbath on that day. And, of course, the Pharisees had their rules. And they immediately noticed this man carrying a load. So the Jews were saying to the man who was cured, it's the Sabbath, and it's not permissible. Well, let me move this up. They're saying to the man, it's the Sabbath, and it's not permissible for you to carry your pallet. Well, the man, of course, was impressed with the fact that he had been made well by somebody, and he's going to do what he said. But he answered them, he who made me well was the one who said to me, pick up your pallet and walk. And then they asked him, who is the man who said to you, pick up your pallet and walk? Now, I have, I'll have you note that there are a couple of sentences there that end in the same phrases, right? Pick up your pallet and walk. Who's the man who said to you, pick up your pallet and walk? But the man who was healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had slipped away while there was a crowd in that place. Later on, Jesus found him in the temple. This is not far from the temple. And his comment here is kind of interesting. Said to him, behold, you've become well. Do not sin anymore so that nothing worse happens to you. What's the implication there? Some linkage between sin and his illness, wasn't there? And so he urges him not to sin. And you remember in Luke, the fifth chapter is a similar case where Jesus was in a house and they tore out the roof and lowered a man because the crowd was so thick. And Jesus said, so that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, he said to the paralytic, I say to you, get up, pick up your stretcher, and go home. So this is a similar sort of case. Do you suppose Jesus had forgiven this man's sins at Bethesda? I think it kind of implies that he had. And in the same process, he healed him. All right, so that's the background for this. And we'll look at the story in the Greek text. Pick up your pallet and walk. It's at the end of the 11th verse. And it's also the end of the 12th verse. Who was the man who said to you, pick up your pallet and walk? And so the scribe, coming along to the junction between the choirs, all right, he is working on the 11th verse, and he makes it end with the top of the next page, and eliminates the 12th verse. We can see how that happened here. Here are the two pages, and we're going to talk about this section down here and how it connects to the section up here. And what I did, we won't go through the details of it, was to put a rectangle around part of it here that we're going to translate. This is all capital letters in Greek, but to read it in a Greek interlinear Greek, English, New Testament, it's upper and lower case. So I had to put a section in there that's the same in upper and lower case, and then we can see what the English is. And so the English is spread out. And notice in the text over here, there's a bunch of gaps. There's a big, long gap here, a gap here. He's pacing himself, a long gap here and here. As he comes down to the critical point of joining this story to the story on the next page, He's spacing it out so that he gets the right word at the end of the page. That seems to be what he's doing. And he doesn't realize he's got another sentence that's supposed to go in there. That he's got room for it, but he doesn't do it correctly. And so when he incidentally, this red arrow is the place up here where the explanation about the angel coming to the waters is supposed to be, and it isn't there. I just wanted to make a note of that. So we look at the top of the next page, and here's the section up here with this translation here. And what we realize is that he says up here, pick up your pallet and walk, but that's the end of the 12th verse, and the scribe doesn't realize that. Now, why would the scribe not be able to go back and check to make sure that he'd gotten all of the words in there? Something interesting has happened that destroyed the first choir, and he didn't have it to check. But he said, when this accident happened, he said, well, that's okay. I've copied this over 100 times or 10 times in the last month. I've got it memorized by now. And so he didn't bother to look. Well, what has happened here? Here's the story. And the pick up your pallet and walk. And in verse 12 is eliminated by the fact that he used this part of which is up here to finish this sentence here. So he eliminates verse 12. And it doesn't change the lesson particularly for them to ask who was the fellow who told you to pick up your pallet and walk. So the man didn't know, and the next verse says that that's the case. So it doesn't really subtract anything from the story by eliminating it, but it gives us a clue about putting together these books. All right. So here are the two pages. And again, you can note, up here, everything is tightly packed, remember? And then along about here where the stain occurs, he begins to make space so that he can wind up with the right words on the bottom line. He may have even written the bottom line there to match into this one and then gone back and filled in the space in between. Something peculiar has happened that effectively destroyed the first choir. And I think the stain is part of the answer. I envisioned it. I tried to think, what would it be like? The scribe is sitting there at a table. He's taken the first choir of the Gospel of John and laid it out on the table. And now he's copying across it onto new sheepskin. He's making a copy of the Gospel of John to send out to other places. That's why he would be writing. And so he has the original John's Gospel before him, laid out in four double pages on the table, and he's copying it off to make a new copy to send to Macedonia or somewhere. And suddenly something happens. What do you suppose it is? This one possibility is a cat comes running through the window, jumps onto the table, and knocks over the inkwell. And the inkwell spills all over his papers that he's copying from, his source papers. And it's destroyed. I mean, the ink ruins everything. And it spatters a little bit onto the copy that he's making. He's gotten down to this point, and there's a blot at that point, and he very quickly picks up a cloth that he has, and he wipes it away. And to his view, at the time, he gets it all off of the page. Says, okay, I can finish this page and have the part that was destroyed by the cat, okay? That's a variation on the dog ate my homework, all right? So now he says, okay, I'll make a substitute and put this in with the rest of John's gospel, and I'll have it. Then I can go back and start over making copies again. I need a complete gospel, and so I'll have to use what I've been doing is making an accurate copy of it. And so I wipe that off. Now, wiping it off and getting rid of the ink at the moment doesn't account for the fact that there's a stain there, but except for the fact that 2,000 years pass, and the traces of the stain grow with the age of the manuscript. And so things like that, remember the oil drops, which probably they wiped right away on the first pages and the last pages of all of these Gospels. Apparently someone looking at them at night with an oil lamp, and they get a sputter or something, and it leaves a little drop, they wipe that off. But over the ages, that grows into a dark spot. And the same thing here. So what I suspect is some kind of an accident happened while he was copying, and he said, okay, I've got this much of it. I'll finish this out. And I remember what was there. And so I've written it 10 times. I know what it is. And so he writes it down. But then he forgets about the fact that there's a duplication in two consecutive verses. So he leaves it out. Now, that turns out not to be critical to the message, but critical to understanding the age of the manuscript. So here, let's see the consequences of it. Sinaiticus has verse 12. This is it. Verse 12 is here. It's interesting that the word for the mattress is krabaton, and the word for the Sabbath is sabbaton. Here it is up here, sabbaton and krabaton. I thought that was kind of an interesting. You could make a pun out of that almost, couldn't you? All right. So, Sinaiticus has it. It's in Alexandricus. Verse 12 is there. And it's also in the Vaticanus as well. So, accurate copies had been made of John's Gospel before the accident. You see where I'm going with this? There were plenty of major manuscripts that had it correctly copied beforehand. And now the scribe has an accident. He replaces the first quire with what he's been copying and ties that in, and that's what winds up with the Codex W in between the wooden covers buried in the sand. And that mistake, that error, that accident might have happened 10, 20 years after the Gospel of John was written. John's not around to change all of the indicators at the end of the Gospel that it was authentic. And so the scribe feels satisfied that he can replace the first quire without having to go back and get John's approval. All right? So he does just a partial replacement. Now, after the replacement is made, some more copies are made. And Henry Sanders looked at that and he said, that's rather curious that we have a gospel that's cobbled together from two sources. Well, he doesn't consider the fact, because he's already decided that it's a 4th or 5th century manuscript, he doesn't consider the fact that we're talking about the scribe trying to keep the original intact, which is what actually I think happened. But Sanders did go do his homework, and he said, well, let's see if this missing verse 12 is in any of the other manuscripts that we have knowledge of. And he found nine manuscripts that omit verse 12, where you can tell that that's what's happened. And these are the names of those manuscripts. Two of them are considerably important. This is the Syriac S and the Old Latin B. They're both translations from the Greek to other languages, but they omit verse 12. And we know why verse 12 was omitted, because the scribe made a mistake in joining the two parts of the book together. Isn't that interesting? Now, you may can think up another explanation for what we've talked about here, but I'm hard-pressed to imagine anything other than the fact that there were copies made when it was intact, there was an accident, it was repaired, there were copies made afterwards, and nine of them still exist. And you know, there were dozens of other manuscripts that didn't survive, some of which had verse 12, some of which didn't. That tells us that this particular copy of John in Codex W was a source copy. It's where the scribe got his material to make copies to send to other parts of the world. Didn't have printing presses. It all had to be done by hand. So, the conclusions, which you have on the back side or one side of your handout. Nine known manuscripts contain, let's see, I have it written down here. Yeah. Nine known manuscripts contain the omission of John 5:12, indicating they were copied from Codex W, or from a manuscript that was copied from Codex W, because these were copied serially, as you well know. They originated, though, I think, from Codex W, and obviously many more than that did not survive to the present, probably also were copied from the flawed Codex W before it was buried. Now, we don't know when it was buried. I mean, it may have been there, and don't know how long the scriptorium lasted, or the cluster of churches in that region of Egypt, but it functioned for a while, and this is how the gospel was distributed to the rest of the world from a central Bible supply source like this. And so they may have been copying other things as well, the writings of Paul and the writings of Peter and John and Jude and so on. So it may have been a source for 100 years. We don't know, although there was a considerable persecution around the turn of the century that may have closed them down, and they just buried the material that was there. And I would suspect if you could go dig in that region, you might find some other buried manuscripts as well. Other major manuscripts do not contain the error, so there must have been copies also made before the choir one, before it was damaged. And therefore, the manuscript in Codex W must have been a primary manuscript of John's Gospel. I think that is a reasonable conclusion. I don't know that it's the only possibility, but we're talking about circumstantial evidence. And we've got already 8 or 10 different reasons for believing that Codex W is an early manuscript, first century manuscript. And it's an eyewitness manuscript, and keep your focus on the fact that we're talking about people who think that the gospel was a hearsay distribution for the first 300 years, because the oldest manuscripts before Codex W were in the 300 and 400 year AD period. So when you're teaching somebody who says, but the gospel's all hearsay, it was decided by a committee hundreds of years after Jesus lived, that's not the case. If Codex W is indeed from eyewitnesses. Okay? And that's today's story. Now, next week, we'll look at something a little more complicated, but it also points to the same direction that we've been talking about. Thank you for your kind attention.